Well, hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good.
I just got back from a vacation.
I did, yeah. I got married and I went on a honeymoon. I feel good, but you know when you come back from vacation and the world kind of floods in and you have tons of work and things like that, but it's a blessing to be employed and it's a blessing to have gone on vacation. So I can't complain on that, but I'm looking forward to next week where that influx of work kind of teeters out just slightly.
Yeah, it's like the reentry phase of coming back.
Yeah. Have you gone away anywhere recently?
2019 was the last time we were on an airplane overseas. But we've started to branch out a little bit more by doing some small weekend things. And one was a weekend before last, because my husband had a job to do in Medford. We decided to go 2 days early, and it took us 2 days to do 24 miles in the Applegate Road between Grants Pass and Medford. And we stayed in a lodge, and we went to wineries, and we hiked. And so that slow travel is kind of how we're easing our way back into it. And we have a trip planned this weekend to go on the other side of Mount Hood to go stay in Durfer and Maupin, which are really small towns, but you know, you can find some really great joy. And then we just kind of wing it and ask locals, where's a trailhead? Or where's a good pub? What do you recommend?
Yeah, that's great.
Just hang out and not travel too far, but travel slowly, but it keeps us, you know, we find things to do that take up a day, and we wish we had more time.
Yeah, sometimes it's best to do small trips close by to places you've never been to before. But I love the idea of asking locals, where do you eat? Where do you drink? So thank you for being on the podcast. I know that we've talked about having you, and then we kind of had a break in podcast recording, but we're back. So I'm really excited about that. You're a woman who does many things, which is great. You're a Renaissance woman, or a multi-potentialite, or a multifaceted person. So I wanted to start out by you kind of talking about all of the things that you do, and then we can delve deeper into what it's like to balance various things in your life.
Indeed. Multi-potentialite, that's a first. I haven't heard that before, and that's really descriptive. Oh, I like that. So where should I start?
Wherever. I mean, what comes to mind is Mighty Aphrodite. We could talk about that. We could talk about your PCC stuff and your community activism. We could talk about real estate stuff. I'm sure there's other things too.
There's quite a few. It's interesting because I feel like I'm young, but I've been around long enough for some things to have come full circle. And so my first degree, my bachelor's degree, was in biology. And I didn't go into that having any idea what I would do to make a living. I just really liked it. And what's amazing about that is I worked part-time at a hospital. And because of that, I was able to get a job in medical sales, even though I had no business background or anything, and that led me into the world of pharmaceuticals. So that's kind of what started. And I was really lucky to be in a couple of companies that really trained us well in terms of business and sales models and consultative selling and things of that nature. And I loved the science part. And going through that, just a quick fast forward, that was my career for a couple of decades. And then there was a time where the industry itself, in a large way, laid people off a lot. And even some of my favorite places to be were these little boutique firms. And the specialties I stayed in predominantly were cardiac medicine and stroke and cardiac surgery. So all pretty much hospital things. But even with that, there was a couple of layoffs. So I decided to go, I already had an MBA, and I decided to go to PSU and get a master's in international management, partly because the last company I was with, they really didn't want to lay us off. There had been a supply chain issue that stopped a product from being on the market for 2 years. And it was just too hard for them to keep all of us. But I talked to the CEO, and because he wanted to expand internationally, I said, if I start getting this degree, you know, can we work together on it? And they were actually very pro doing that. It didn't work out. The degree timeline was too long, but it was a really good feeling to think that they didn't want to just kick us to the curb, mm-hmm. you know. And getting the international master's was, it was something that kind of brought me back to earth and thought, okay, what can I do? What's a change? What could be something different? And I also stumbled upon the certificate for the business of social enterprise. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is the coolest thing ever. Not just getting the master's, but discovering this certificate at Portland State, because I was kind of the person who would always say, hey, can we do more recycling? Or hey, can we consider ideas about what can we do for community? And it had always been there, and I never knew what to call it. So I got this certificate, and that took about a year and a half. And it was so worth it, because as I was leaving an industry that I was really well networked in, but with that being well networked in, I traveled like 5 states. And I'm platinum on American for Life, and I don't want that on my tombstone, but that gives you an idea of I lived around here, but I didn't stay around here much. And in terms of social life and friends, it was all revolved around work. So after those layoffs and going to Portland State, and particularly that social enterprise certificate, I got to know a local ecosystem and started getting into the Portland ecosystem of entrepreneurship and social enterprise. And it's like, even though I'd lived here already, I was getting to learn a whole new Portland that way. So that led me to one of my teachers was in a tech startup, and he was hiring. So he hired me, and this was in mid-2014. And I was the third person he hired, and together he and I hired a team of 9 people. And it was a tech startup that was focused on entertainment and also some healthcare. And I was primarily excited about the healthcare side, but the entertainment side is really interesting too. And even though I don't know a lot about tech, but what I saw was some real potential for what technology can do to help people. And that was such a great experience. It didn't last very long though, because even though we were working and we were doing some interesting things to try to work with Providence Child Center to help create technology that could help a person communicate with someone who'd had a stroke or a cerebral palsy or something of that nature, because it could help identify their feelings, because people are really hard to read if you don't know what's in them. Really only parents and caregivers who have known them a long time can really tell what's going on with someone like that. And it had so much potential, but what we didn't realize at the time was our CEO was, we think, embezzling money from the investors. We weren't getting paid. We were kept being told, you know, think of it as equity, and when we pay, we'll pay you with a bonus. And it just got to the point where it was not sustainable. So what I did at that time, because I had 9 people under me and I had this love of social enterprise and I'd done B Corp certifications for companies through Portland State, I thought, well, I just want to keep doing that. That was really great. So I created Mighty Epify Consulting partly to help those guys that suddenly didn't have jobs anymore and we had to sue our company for back pay, but to give them a place to park a 1099 to say there's no gaps in their resume, right? That they had something to go into. And for me to start reaching out as a B Corp consultant and say, hey, I'm here. And that's kind of what turned a new leaf for me to be further and deeper into the, I guess, the ecosystem of social enterprise in Portland and getting to know more and more about this incredible place that we have for entrepreneurship.
And tell me and tell our listeners, I mean, what is a B Corp? I mean, I know, you know,
right.
but and then what does it mean to be a consultant for B Corps?
Yes. So B Corp is something that has been around for about 20 years, and it is a third party assessed certification for businesses that wish to be recognized as social impact businesses that are doing a certain degree of things while earning a profit for their employees, for society, for community, for customers, for the environment. And it's measured objectively by a third party. And this can give a company, once they reach 80 points on this very intensive assessment, can give them the badge of B Corp that is becoming increasingly more recognizable, that a company has a set of values. There's also Benefit Corporation for Good certification, which is very similar. And there are other certifications that companies strive for, like green certifications. And think of it as, for other types of businesses, it's like LEED is to buildings, B Corp is to businesses. And it also came about in part because, particularly in the 90s, when there were these things called, or it still are, I'm trying to think of exactly what to call it, but companies would create their own report about how well they were doing.
Like an annual report.
Annual report, but also a part of it that says, these are our impacts, this is what we're doing. And some were very true and honest about it, but some of them weren't. And that's called greenwashing. Mm-hmm. And I think in part, B Lab and B Corp certifications were created to help alleviate greenwashing, because it's like making a claim that isn't true. Mm-hmm. And it's like saying we're environmentally friendly while they're really dumping pesticides, you know, down the drain or something like that. And it still happens to some degree, but the whole idea of benefit corporations and certifying was to help alleviate that and to help give consumers and stakeholders and all of us a chance to say, yes, there's companies out here that do good things and they walk the talk, and someone has assessed that and said, yes, this is true. Mm-hmm. So it gives us something to go on.
So say a company, wants to go through that process.
Mm-hmm.
And they contact you, you know, and they say, Kim, what you're doing sounds great. Mm-hmm. I want to go through this process. What does that look like, or what kind of services are we talking?
It's changed over time. The B Corp certification is really rigorous. It's five standards, which are governance, environment, employees, community, and customers. And In those buckets, there are a lot of questions, and it's done on algorithms based on the sector that the company is in. So it's a really rigorous engine, and it's done on a point system. So you go in and answer some questions and points gather, and the ideal is to be, it takes 80 to even become a B Corp. Ideal is becoming much higher than that. And with that, they also ask for documentation. So answering a question doesn't mean you just get to say, yeah, I do this, I do that. It really needs to have some documentation with it. And it's used to be 3 or 4 months due to COVID. And this is really interesting. Because of COVID, there were more applications for B Corp than there have been B Corps to date before that. And I just learned that from a webinar that I was on. And it's created such a backlog for B Lab itself that the last certification I helped a company with took 18 months. Mm-hmm. And part of it is, and we get companies ready, you submit the form, and then you wait. And then because B Lab has their own assessors that are assigned to companies that help guide those companies, but they're also the ones that are really vetting the answers to all the questions. And they just don't have enough manpower. And and the excitement and the desire to become B Corp has increased so much. So it's mm-hmm. it's an interesting way to become backlogged, because a lot of it is just because of demand.
Mm. And the other certifiers that exist, you mentioned some of those.
Mm-hmm.
They potentially aren't as rigorous and maybe have less of a waiting period.
That's correct. The one I'm familiar with, Benefit Corporations for Good, you know, which you have already interviewed Tom Herring in a great podcast a few months ago. That one has expanded into several states. It is, I'd say it's less rigorous because it isn't as long, but it is still rigorous and it still covers similar pillars, and they also add leadership, and it also takes a lot of documentation to prove what a company is doing, and the expectation is that and that Tom also assesses a company and takes them through a period of mentorship, and the other thing that all these companies are expected to do is an annual benefit report that shows what they're doing. So I help with all those services. Basically, the way I look at it is there are companies that are doing well, but they're working so hard. And being an entrepreneur takes a lot of time. Being a founder takes time. You know, owning a small company takes time. And they may want to do an assessment, but there's no time for it. So I help carry the time burden. But also, sometimes when you're inside your company so well, so much, making a product or providing a service, that all those other things are additional. It's hard to see all the possibilities. Mm-hmm. So also as a consultant, I really quiz them on how, you know, how are they interacting with their employees, their community, environmentally, and what might be missing, and try and get some decision-making about, are we doing well? Is there more that can be done? Is there another direction they would like to go? And how to look at things with an equity lens too. I think that's a really, really critical thing to do is almost everything, even if it's environmental, there's an equity stake in things as well. And it's eye-opening for a lot of companies. And then they can choose how much resources so they can remain profitable. How many resources do you want to give toward either philanthropy or volunteerism or time in other ways, like doing events, all those things add up. So it's a matter of decision making so that the company can also be a viable company.
Mm. And I imagine, you know, some of our listeners are small businesses, yeah, and they may be saying, I'm just trying to keep my head above water and trying to pay my bills. I can't worry about sustainability practices or certifications or things like that. I guess my question for you is, regardless of whether or not someone's ready to get certified, what are some things that they can do as a small business owner to be on the path of becoming being a social enterprise? Like, what are some choices they can make?
Sure.
Or what are some things that they can do potentially a little more intentional than a non-social enterprise?
Indeed, part of it's going to come down to marketing. And I find there's two companies that some that market their product, their service, and their mission, vision, and values, and some that forget the last part and just don't put the, it's not the energy, it's almost like a shyness about saying too much about the values part. And what I would remind those companies is that Nielsen did a study, I think it was in 2017, that said that there are consumers who are willing to pay, and this is over 60% of consumers worldwide, are willing to pay more if they know that a product or service comes from a company that has good values. So this is the crux of it. We want to help those people find you. Mm. And so part of it is marketing, good marketing about what good you're doing in the world as well as what the product and service is. And sometimes the product or service is the good, right? And then the expectation is to still do some philanthropic things. But there are people who are literally creating products that are changing the world. Then there are others. An example I'm going to use is Green Drop Garage, because auto mechanics and oil changes historically has not been an environmentally friendly industry, but yet this is a B Corp company. Mm-hmm. And it's just incredible what they do, because they do the best they can to be really diligent and environmentally friendly with this industry. And then the rest of it is community and how the employees are treated.
So the idea is that some people are doing naturally good services, you know, social justice related things, health related things. And then some people You could be a printing shop or an auto garage. I was going to say a dentist's office, but I guess that's doing something good as well. But mm-hmm. you could be any kind of business, and you can find those social enterprise items to implement into your business.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. You could be a lawyer.
You can. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I guess my question for you is, how do you look at a business that wants to do this? Where do you begin? I mean, do you ask them questions about, I imagine them becoming good or them being good or them, you know, yes, it is marketing, but it starts with actually creating those values and creating those service or product changes. So, I mean, what's kind of the approach for when you begin that conversation? Is it, what are the things that you could do differently? Is it kind of looking at their product line or their services and making suggestions? How do you go about this process, I guess?
Yeah, it's all of the above, really. And it kind of depends upon how they come about it. I see some people who haven't even started a business yet, and they say, I want to be a B Corp. It's like, all right, what do you do? And they don't even have that much established. But I love that there's that energy that they have a vision that this could happen. But initially, what it really takes is a good conversation. And I always have a client services agreement, which, full disclosure, you're my attorney and you wrote for me. And so using that, and, you know, it's a confidential process, but I need to know the company's heart and soul, as well as, you know, the sales and all of those things. And because through time, I've really gotten some good business training and have become an entrepreneur myself, it's sometimes it's just revealing to someone in a business to have somebody from the outside come in and ask some questions, because it helps all of us. It helps me too when someone asks me questions that they don't know what I do or what my day is like, to ask those, because sometimes it makes me sit back and think, yeah, I'm so deep in this sometimes that I can't see the forest for the trees. So that's mm-hmm. part of my goal. And to really ask them, what are their goals? What are the visions? Take it from the top first. You know, what are the big goals and the visions? How do you want to be known? What impacts do you want to make? As well as being profitable, which is an impact, mm-hmm. because profit helps you. If people have employees, that's good for community. How do you want the employees to be treated? How do you want the community to be treated? And then sometimes they just can't see what it might be. So I help with ideas. Do you want to make impacts locally? Do you want to make them globally? And an example of this is with me and a lot of solopreneurs. It's really hard to make an environmental impact when you work from home. Mm-hmm. And there's one of us for service entrepreneurs. But one of the ways we can do something is through organizations and donating and volunteering with them. And 1% for the planet is really interesting, because they allow you to upload receipts of donations to organizations that have aligned with them. And an interesting way to think of something, and this is how I would talk to a client as well, is where do you want to focus? And then think about what you could do through something like 1% for the planet if you're a service organization. And for me, I can touch the environment and do it with an equity lens locally by giving to Growing Gardens, mm-hmm. which is one of the local organizations that actually reaches to communities that are marginalized, as well as doing something environmental, and it's based on food. There's all sorts of ways to do that. But the other thing is, if you love turtles and you want to save turtles, do that too. Mm. It's also thinking about what else can someone do? I'll give an example of one of the clients that I have that just became a B Corp. And they have a lot to do with books. And it's actually bookshop.org. It's their B Corp, so that's public record. They're an amazing company that gives a lot to independent bookstores. But the other thing they do that they didn't realize until we got into conversation is they highlight authors, Black authors, Indigenous authors, LGBTQ authors, and not only about their biographies, but some of these people are science fiction writers. Some of them are write comics. And they highlight it. They don't put New York Times bestseller list people on there. They put new authors on. I said, you're giving credence to a lot of authors by doing this as well. And noticing that, that's something that also ends up being scores on points on a B-Lab assessment, but that's not why they do it, right?
Yeah.
They do it for the greater good. So there's all sorts of ways to think about it. And if someone's stuck and saying, I want to make an impact, I really don't know how to start, to help give them ideas, but find where their heart is first and what's the most important thing to the founders, to the employees. The other thing is I'm really big on saying when you're hiring people, let them know where your values are. Try to do as much as you can with an equity-centered lens. And when the employees are onboarded, really let them embrace that value too and make something of it, because sometimes the best ideas can come from the people within.
Mm-hmm.
And the impacts within are just as important as the impacts that are outward facing. And I firmly believe that. And it's also interesting that, at least with B Corp, now B2B company certifications have surpassed B2C. Business to business has surpassed business to consumer. Mm. So it's really fascinating.
Yeah, the businesses are choosing other businesses with values to work with.
Indeed. And another thing I love about it is it kind of becomes, it becomes exponential. Because you think about, as businesses, even solopreneurs, we work with other people. We contract with 1099s, or we have suppliers. And by talking about it, it can inspire others. And then when more and more companies go out with a social enterprise mindset and increase and improve their values and start to let the world know so that they can be found, it all improves. But I don't want it to sound like certification is the end all be all. There are some really good companies that are doing some wonderful things that don't want to certify. And there's a variety of reasons for that. My thing that I really want companies to think about is that 66% that will pay more for your product or service is just make sure they can find you.
And these businesses are doing well. There's this sort of notion that if I do good things or if I donate to a cause, you know, I'm eating into my bottom line, or I'm not going to have money. But you actually get more people who are loyal come back to you. So there's a fallacy that if you do good as a business, that you're losing money or you're somehow not going to recoup the money. But I would argue that it's the other way around.
It can be. It can be. And, you know, and we're talking about businesses. Nonprofits can be partners, but B Corp and B Lab are, they're not about nonprofits. This is all for-profit companies. And you're absolutely right. It can make a difference. And yet you still have to, you know, watch your expenses, do your taxes and all those things. And it's about people, planet, and profit. But a case in point is I am officiating my nephew's wedding in November.
Oh, cool.
And they shared what their color scheme is. So I don't have any dress in that color that she wants. So I went online to say eco-friendly dresses. And I was surprised how little popped up in a search. And luckily I found one. And I found one that's very eco-friendly, and they're really aware of fabric waste. Apparently fashion is one of the most environmentally unfriendly sectors of industry. And I found one. But that's what I mean about that. You know, they want to find you. And the thing about certifying is it puts companies on a directory.
Mm-hmm.
It can help make them more searchable. And it gives the credence of a third-party objective assessment that has put the stamp on.
Instead of just saying you're good, you have a third party say that you're good.
Exactly.
It's a little more believable that way.
Exactly.
What's odd to me is in an ideal world, this is just how people or businesses would be.
Yes, we'd hope.
So we're I mean, the world is what it is, right? But we have a need to sort of piece out or filter the bad businesses from the good. And then we look at the good and we have to figure out what's really good and what is just greening or pink washing or any of those things. So it's odd to me that I mean, I see the utility in this, obviously. I mean, you mentioned earlier a law firm's a benefit company. But it's odd to me that businesses, I mean, maybe I'm a dreamer and a realist, but businesses should just have to have some sort of social responsibility as well. It should just be part of the business model.
I totally agree. And I think back in the day, the local grocer or the pharmacist or the banker, a lot of them were contributing to their communities pretty consistently. And what happened is, you know, we know the Milton Friedman and some history of increases of capitalism in the 80s and 90s and doing everything for the shareholders. And I was witness to that. You know, in my corporate career, I worked for mostly publicly traded companies, but a few that weren't. And the vast difference between cultures, between one or two of them, was really profound. And my favorite CEOs were the ones that really, really cared. And yes, they were beholden to their shareholders and we had to have quotas to meet. But they also said, like one of them, his goal was to eradicate TB. And another one's goal was to eradicate malaria. Mm-hmm. And even though we had drugs for different things, but, you know, I saw that. So it is possible that even publicly traded companies can do that. But then there's others that didn't feel that at all. It was all about, you know, you better make quota or you'll be fired. Or, you know, and some of that mentality. So, you know, we know we've seen that historically. Mm-hmm. And it seems that some companies really, they don't want to go down that route. They don't want to start down that route. And B Corp has helped really create and benefit corporations for good and like lead buildings, really helped, I think, raise some awareness among
I've
consumers.
Also worked for companies that have told me, do that on your own time.
Yes.
You know, like they didn't want to do it as a business. They say, well, if you want to be involved in the community, you can do that on your own. So I think that's part of it too, is this is telling the world that business can be for profit, but can also be for planet and for people, that triple bottom line.
Right.
Can
I say something too? Yeah. Don't you think doesn't it stress you out too to have to be, it's almost like take masking. You've got to have the mask for business and then take the mask off to go home to be yourself. And true joy at work mm-hmm. is when that's seamless.
Yeah. I mean,
you don't have to mask.
I'm an attorney and today, depending on the day, but today mm-hmm. I'm sitting in shorts and wearing mm-hmm. a hat because I didn't just wear something fancy today to wear something fancy. So following the rules mm-hmm. is great and having corporate responsibility. But authenticity and community and, you know, all those things, I think they make for a better society. They make for a better community. You're absolutely mm-hmm. right. Everybody in these careers, they're forced to put on masks or historically. I actually had a circumstance today. I went to, not a bad circumstance, but I went to Sheridan's Market, which is by our office. And the guy asked me, like, well, what do you do for work? And I said, I'm a lawyer. And he's like, oh, you're a lawyer and you dress like that? And I was just like, yeah. And, you know, I said, yeah, I do, depending on the day. But it just made me think about how there's a certain way that we want a business to act or a lawyer to act or, and granted there's a time and a place. Like if, you know, you're going to court, you're not going to wear flip flops like I'm mm-hmm. wearing today. But that said, the world would be a better place if we were just authentically who we are, doing the thing we were passionate about or we had skills in, and then having that translate. It seems like we would all do better because the people that we experience every day, not only would they be happy, but then we would get services from people who are doing services in a way that are so close to who they are. So you're absolutely right. We put on these masks, they kind of interfere with with what we should be.
Yeah, it brings back some memories, but it's encouraging. And I always tend to be the optimist. You know, the glass is more than half full. And and I see so many companies around us that if they're really striving to do.
I was going to ask you what you thought about the whole Patagonia owner and situation. And, you know, I think he's giving his company to climate justice. You know, companies and leaders who do things like that. I'm trying to think of someone else, Jeff Bezos' ex-wife, Melinda Gates, you know, people who have tons of money or have tons of exposure or the ability to make change, they sometimes do, and then others sometimes don't. On one hand, we might think, well, Patagonia is really big and I'm not Patagonia, I can't do that. But on another, someone could potentially be inspired by that and have either a more employee-owned business or have a business that donates to the environment. So I guess my question for you is, what is your thought on large corporations or large companies like Patagonia, who we know nationally, taking on one of those social enterprise models or changes, and how that affects everybody who's experiencing that or watching that in America?
Wow, that's a big question. And I know the most recent announcement, and I know just on the surface, I haven't gotten into really read deeply into what his most recent decision was. But following Patagonia through the years, they've always had the mantra that we want you to buy a coat that will last you a lifetime. And if you rip it, bring it to us and we'll sew it up for you. You know, that's always been part of it. And I know they give a lot environmentally, and they're a B Corp. Can it be inspiring? I hope so. I think there are companies that intrinsically have this, and then there are some that don't. But remember, 3-4 years ago, the first letter from Larry Fink at BlackRock that was calling CEOs out, and remember, those are publicly traded, that clean up your act, do better for the environment, or we're going to stop investing. Did that make a big change over time? Because he's written other letters since. Doesn't seem to have moved the needle all that much. But I think Patagonia is a really amazing example of what someone's value set can do. And would it change others? All I can say is I just hope so. And I also see there are some companies here in Portland that aren't well known at all that still carry those values. And an example that I think of that they won't certify, which is a choice. But this is about making furniture out of only reclaimed wood in Indonesia, because there were times when, you know, think of teak trees. You know, teak was a very, very valuable wood. And back in the early 20th century, and maybe even before, people go in and tear down hundreds of trees to get to one teak tree and throw the other trees in the river and destroy an ecosystem. And the ones in the river have since been bogged, and it's changed the wood. And his name is Tim O'Brien, who traveled over there and found that. And they take this entombed wood out. And what he's done is created a company where they pay the people in Indonesia a greater salary than they would if they were working rubber or palm plantations. They're being taught a new skill set, which is furniture making. And they have benefits for them and their families. And we get beautiful furniture here in Portland and other places when it's shipped over. I think it's just amazing. It'll last a lifetime.
Well, that's a big difference in the stories we hear about human rights violations.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
So I'm wondering, I know you're married to a doctor as well, and he's great. And you're also married to a doctor who was working during COVID, which had to be an experience. So tell me kind of what is living with a doctor? How does that affect your life and your relationship together? I know that he is one of those people who's doing the work directly in that way.
Yeah.
Do you both kind of have conversations about society or about what needs to change?
Very much. Oh, the frustration about just from the beginning of COVID, you know, some of a distance frustrations, like different states, different governors felt differently about things like masking and vaccines than others. And that can trickle into their communities. In the beginning, it was just hard work and really protecting themselves because there were no vaccines yet. But the numbers were real. And it was really, I think, frustrating, particularly to the nurses and physicians. I mean, they all worked really hard, but the nurses are the ones that wear, they call it the PAPR, which is a pressure regular thing. It's like a helmet and it's got a plastic drape that comes down that they can see through it. And then it has the gown. So when they're going into a room, they have positive pressure that's pushing anything out to protect them. Well, a nurse that has one or two patients has to wear that thing all day long. A doctor has to wear it to go in and maybe do a procedure or see the patient, but a lot of times they can stay outside and just wear a mask and scrubs, but still being very, very cautious. And the shortages of things were scary. So that's going back a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting is how families react to things. Like there are some families that just don't believe COVID was even there and they wanted their person to be saved no matter what. And you know, COVID was killing people. And
still is. Yeah.
Still is. And there was, you know, there were times, and I don't know about now, but there was a temporary morgue behind the hospital for months. And there's a reason for that. And it was COVID. So the reality of it was really, really something. The other thing is, so we have been through four pandemics as a couple, and each one of them changed something. One changed a vacation to Peru. I think that was H1N1. Another was SARS. I forget the other one.
And Ebola? No.
COVID was just, and so each time there's been some kind of a, we had to give things up, change a vacation, but nothing like COVID. And I think in the time that I've known him, they may have had to call in backup, maybe for one or two nights, like every few years.
Mm-hmm.
During COVID, they were like, I think at one point there were four people on backup for days on end. So that just gives you an idea of it. And the other thing about timing of it was there was a new ICU planned to be built and it opened just as COVID was starting. So you go from having two units, a cardiac unit and a regular ICU unit, to having a third one, and one of those becomes a dedicated COVID unit, and that's all it is. And that went on for months too.
And did he come home and talk or cry or avoid that situation to try to keep that in a package deal where you compartmentalize things? Like, what's his method for that, for dealing with that? Or
I think with each of them it's probably a little of all of the above.
Mm-hmm.
And but the way doctors work in the system is, it used to be you'd work all day and then come home and be on call. So sometimes there wouldn't be sleep because the phone would ring, and sometimes they have to go in. Sometimes it's answer questions. Now it's 24-hour coverage in two 12-hour shifts. So there's always someone there that cannot leave the building. But what it gives is, for the person who gets to sign out, it gives them, like, they're not going to get phone calls. It's always tiring, but it's nice to come home. And really, one of the ways to handle it is talk about it. But the other is, watch mindless streaming television. Yeah. And I think that's any of us, right? It's sometimes there's got to be something to settle the mind. And we've watched some great programs together that are partly just catharsis and therapy. And then go back to it the next day. One of the impacts it made, though, is sometimes the transition period between a physician coming on and a physician coming off would overlap because it's so busy that the one leaving needs to catch up on the paperwork. So they're overlapping maybe an hour or two when the new one's coming in, taking the baton to actually see the patients. And that happened a lot. My role has been to be chief baker and treat maker for all those nurses and just, you know, try and do things to help. Last Thanksgiving, I cooked an entire turkey and stuffing and everything for them. And I couldn't go in the front door. Mm-hmm. So I made this feast, and I knew they were bringing in some side dishes. And I just drove it up to the front door and said, okay, I'm here. bring out the cart. And they all ran out in their scrubs and whisked it away. So, some of those things to happen to help people feel just a little bit more connected to the outside world. Because I used to work in a hospital. When I was going to college and getting that biology degree, I worked in a trauma center and I did EKGs and a little bit of respiratory therapy. And that's partly how I got my job in medicine. And I just love the atmosphere. So before COVID, when I could even, and in my pharma career, I often went in and did in-services in ICUs. I've been in surgeries. I've seen open hearts. I've seen brain surgery. I've seen these things. And gosh, with COVID, I couldn't even get in the front door just to say hi. So part of it is me feeling disconnected from something that I'm really familiar with and wanting to go in there and say, hey, are you doing okay? What can I do? What can I bring you? Mm.
Yeah. Well, thank you to Greg for so many years of service. And he retired recently, right?
Well, retirement for him is kind of like a dimmer switch. It's not an off switch. he's still working a little bit, like on call, fill in, because other people need vacations. Some people get sick. So, and going down to Medford is part of the system to help out down there. So, and that's good. I think it's hard to shut off something you love. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of it to love. So.
Well, thank you. I have 5 questions for you.
Yes.
This is the questions that we ask every podcast guest at the end. there's no right or wrong answer. The first one is, what's a quote or a mantra that you live by?
There's a few of them, actually. I think carpe diem is one. And one that I learned when I was traveling in a hostel, an Irishman came up and to sit, hey, may I sit with you and have tea, and asked me what I was going to explore that day. And I told him where I wanted to go. And he said, in a very deep Irish brogue, he said, look up, always remember to look up. And I think that has expanded my worldview probably more than any quote that I've ever heard, because he said, somebody put effort into making the beautiful architecture of buildings. And there's more in nature above you than you'd ever realize if you keep looking straight ahead or looking down at your feet. So look up.
That's great. What's your favorite childhood memory?
Oh, there's a few. So I have an interesting childhood because my father was English, and I was born in the U.S. and so was my sister, but we lived in Holland, Belgium, and England. And one of my favorite memories was wooden shoes in Holland when I was like 6 years old. I thought they were the coolest thing. And in England, just once I was introduced to ponies and knew that I could ride, I would have lived with them, slept with them. I think horses, it's like the little girl thing, right? It's the love of horses was real. So that was one of my favorite things. And we'd go explore. And we found some Roman ruins in the village of Chedworth, where we lived. And we're very delicate with them, but they were like in overgrown bushes and things. And we see these walls, and it turned out that the Chedworth Roman Villa has some of the best preserved mosaics of any Roman ruins in the British Isles, and it's now a full-blown museum. And we just ride our ponies there. Oh. So that's an amazing memory. Countryside memories and just daydreaming about living in the countryside and always having a horse and a couple dogs around me.
Well, I know you have dogs. You think you'll get a horse one day?
I owned a horse when I was in high school in Colorado and loved her. But horses are harder than dogs. Mm-hmm. They take a lot of work. I don't think I have the capacity to give a horse a good life anymore. And I don't have the land for it. And they need a lot. Mm-hmm. But I'd still like them.
Yeah. You should go horseback riding sometime. I haven't been in ages.
I want to do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah. What issue or issues keep you up at night?
Oh, my goodness.
I know there's a lot.
Yeah. Two. One is truly, really climate. I mean, very much climate, because last summer when we got to 114 degrees and I'd planted baby trees, and it's like I was their lifeline. I literally had to pour water on these trees to keep them alive. You know, the rest of them would have to do what they could, but that was a real reality check, that heat dome. And and the other thing is just our nation and the polarization that I am reading about more and more and more. And I've read a lot about it just to try and keep up, but it's really disturbing that it's hard for people to have conversations. And I think what's really missing is, because of the polarization, and the only thing we really hear about is either the radical left or the, you know, the far right, and all the conspiracies within is, you know, what about the people, like, probably a few of us who would rather talk about an issue at a time. And sometimes it might be moderate. Sometimes it might be progressive. Sometimes it might be liberal. Sometimes it might be more conservative, depending on the issue. And sit down and have a cup of coffee with somebody and go through those instead of this
Andy's dad is a Republican, and he and I talk all the time about
that's
everything.
Great.
And, you know, he's a retired CPA. We have nothing in common, but we talk about actual conservative values, not conspiracies. Like, we actually talk about education and family and health and safety. I think that's part of the issue, is not only the normalization of hate, but how do you talk, and this is a question we can't answer today, we don't have time, how do we talk to people who they're not starting with fact, or they're not, you know, they're starting with hate. I think that's something that's difficult, is finding out who the people are that you're talking about. How do we find out that that's someone who actually wants to have a conversation?
I agree. And I think, you know, and with the polarization, is just when it felt like things were getting better. And I always grew up thinking, wow, there's been, you know, World War, and there's been a Holocaust. So because of that, it won't happen again, because we as a species are smart enough to figure that out. Well, how wrong I was.
And then came Fox News.
Yeah, indeed. And just to think about how, you know, I thought white supremacy was kind of going away, but it's welled back up. And so the need for really good inclusivity and sensitivity and looking at things with an equity lens and trying to be good stewards of communities as well, so that people have a chance. That's on my mind a lot also.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It is a lot.
What are you reading or watching these days?
I am reading a book called Agent Sonia, which is about a spy in World War II. And I read a book. I'm not a very good reader. I'm really slow. But I listen to books when I'm driving. So I read Wilding, and now I'm listening to Wilding to pick up even more. And it's about the wilding of a British farm. And it's a passion for me, because that's what my husband and I are doing. And Battleground is literally wilding and trying to create habitat on 10 acres. And that's where the biology is. Remember, I said things come full circle sometimes. that biology major just got like, oh, I get something to really, really do and think about. And so we're really trying to literally create habitat. I'm get certifications for it. We're working with Clark Conservation, and it's a labor of love.
What are you watching these days?
Reading a book called Wilding and listening to it, and watching anything that helps my husband relax. That's like streaming video. We finished Better Call Saul, so we're kind of distraught. It's like, what's next? So we went to Reservation Dogs, finished that. It's like we're looking for the next thing. And but musically, I have been a Sting fan for ages. But part of it is I also recently learned that when I lived in England, in Yorkshire, the village we lived in is only about 10 miles from where he grew up. And he did a musical called The Last Ship, which is about that village and the shipmakers. And I also like Jean-Baptiste, and who won like an armful of Grammys this year, like
Jean-Baptiste.
A bunch of them. And
it's so much about love and community. Oh, yeah.
And he did so much during COVID. I mean, just taking music into the streets. And there was a time when, and I don't watch late night TV very much, but on Colbert, you know, Jean-Baptiste is on Colbert. And the reason I stayed up to watch is because I knew Sting was a guest. And I thought, oh, they're going to do something musical. What better pairing than Jean-Baptiste and Sting, right? And I am so PO'd at Stephen Colbert's people or whoever arranges it, because all he did was bring Sting on and ask him 13 really silly questions. And they didn't get any interaction with Jean-Baptiste. And I thought, but that would have been a beautiful moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I should have been the director of that particular episode.
Do you prefer solo Sting or Police Sting?
Well, there's a lot more of the solo Sting. And Police Sting is a little younger, so I listen to more Police Sting probably now. And I've actually seen the Police when they did a tour, but that was really short-lived. But I have everything Sting ever did, so it's all of the above.
And then the last part of this, who do you want to give a shout out to that's doing a good job in the community? And then how can people find you?
Okay, the shout outs thing. You is one. I think you do a tremendous amount.
You're very sweet. I'm not,
well, it's real,
I'm not
though.
Paying you to say this.
I know. No, it's real, because I see what your law firm has become, who you bring on board, all those webinars that you do, and just the true heart and soul. And you teach legal issues for the business builders class at SBDC. So that I think is tremendous. I'm going to give shout outs to mostly the locals that are doing tremendous things for community that may not be recognized for that. Like White Bird Dance is more than modern dance. It is by bringing in companies that are telling stories, literally telling stories through dance, it can really help reach communities and bring people together. And it's very, very intentional. And when you see a dance that's beautiful, that's one thing. They're all beautiful. These people are incredibly athletic and they can do amazing things. But when there's a dance about a thing, like the Central Park Five, or there's about a thing, like there was one called Woke, it really starts to tap people on the shoulder and create a bit of discomfort to say, we've got to really recognize what the world looks like and bring some optimism. So Whiteboard, and they do a lot of outreach. They bring dance companies to schools. They fill the schnitz with school kids that come in to watch dance. So I think it's the arts is part of what builds communities. I think organizations like Be Local that are really trying to do a lot about what we talked about earlier and foster community around among companies that are doing things for good and to help and support them. And not all of them have to be certified. It's becoming increasingly welcoming and there's a lot of outreach there. The ones that are global, like Global PDX and World Oregon, I think there's great lectures that are happening and worth listening to. Some of them are based on history and where we are now, and some are climate related. There's quite a few. Oregon Entrepreneur Network is another one that's really super supportive of entrepreneurs. And Built Oregon, another ecosystem that is supportive of consumer goods entrepreneurs. That gives me a lot of hope and joy that, you know, when things feel a little crushing in a big way, when we're talking about politics or something, to know that there's a lot of good happening in Oregon when we peel back the layers.
How do people find you?
They find me on, it is an annoying name that a lot of people don't know how to spell. It's mightyepiphyte.com. And Mighty Epiphyte is MIGHTYEPIPHYTE. And the biology major who owns a business named it that because epiphytes are like orchids or bromeliads. They're plants with air roots, and they have a symbiotic relationship, usually living in trees. So they're like entrepreneurs. They build something beautiful, and they need a supportive network. So it's a metaphor. I know. See what you do when you get the biology major.
You are quite a woman. I'm really happy to have you not only on this podcast, but as a friend and as a legal client, and as a community member. I think this community is very lucky to have you. So thank you for
give one more shout out?
Yeah, have a chance? Course.
How can I not shout these two out? Hunter Nowak of In a Landscape. Why this is important. Because by taking a 9-foot Steinway into parks and literally into landscapes, part of it is because the WPA said that the arts are just as important for communities and humanities as post offices and roads. And they were right. And Hunter Nowak caught on to that. And he's an amazing pianist. He's totally talented and genius. But his heart is in bringing this music to people who have never heard it before, doing it for some for free, and also highlighting these landscapes that in his heart says, we need to protect these. So when you combine those two things, it's an experience, like, and I call it therapy. I say, not only when is my next therapy session, but where is it? Which landscape is it? And then the other one I want to give a shout out to is Thomas Lauderdale and Pink Martini, because their music is good, and you know, we've done that music for years. But he also nurtures artists and really does a tremendous amount for artists and for artistry and for helping. So there's with both and Whitebird and a lot of organizations, there's so much behind the scenes that they don't put on their websites. And I think that's worth noting.
Well, I think you're great. Thank you for being in my life, and thank you for doing this podcast. I really appreciate you and hope you have a good rest of your night.
Thank you. It sure goes fast. It's such a joy to talk to you.
Oh.